Imagine you're a young child, maybe 6 or 7 years old, and you head to the local theater to catch a matinee all by yourself. You're a pretty hardened horror fan despite your young age, but what you see scares you so much that you literally pray for the sunshine to last. You do not want night to fall. The movie sticks with you for decades, and when you become a filmmaker, you remake it as a way of purging it from your system. That's exactly what happened to Indonesian filmmaker Joko Anwar. The movie? Satan's Slaves. So I'm your host, Sherry. This is your friendly reminder that, as always, we'll be breaking down the plot in great detail. That means there will be loads of spoilers, so if you haven't seen the movie, go watch it. And I feel like this is an underrated movie, so if you're listening and you haven't watched it, turn the episode off and go and watch it and then come back. Otherwise, proceed at your own risk. Joining us to talk about Satan's Slaves is Jen. Jen, how's it going?
Hi, it's going good. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming back. How have you been?
Been pretty good. You know, it's getting into spooky season, so I'm watching lots of horror movies, which is always a good thing.
Nice. Have you watched anything really good lately?
You know, one thing I saw lately was actually, it's not a full horror, it's more like gateway horror, but it's the movie Wendell and Wild that's coming to Netflix soon. It's from Henry Selick, who directed Nightmare Before Christmas, with Jordan Peele and Keegan-Michael Key as two demonic brothers. So, very fun, very cute. I would recommend.
Nice. I love gateway horror, especially. It's funny because I think as horror fans, we watch horror all year round, but for some reason around spooky season, I like to watch those gateway horror movies that I don't watch throughout the year. I don't know what it is. It brings up the kid in me, I guess.
Yeah, it's one of those movies that if it came out when I was 10, I would have been my entire personality because it's just that perfect mix of like a good kids movie, but like a great spooky movie. So.
Awesome. I'll have to look for it. And how is your podcast going? Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah. So my podcast is called I Hate Your Taste in Movies. Myself and two of my friends, Jackie and Austin. Austin has been on Scaredy Cats before as well. But we all have very different taste in movies. We love really different things. And so we're always inflicting movies on one another. And I'm the resident horror fan. So I'm always trying to convince them that The Evil Dead is good and stuff like that.
Which I love that Austin came on to talk about The Exorcist, like of all horror movies, and she's not a horror fan, and that's what she came on to talk about. That's fantastic.
Yeah, I mean, it scarred her for life, but she's now seen it multiple times. She's read the book. She's read the screenplay. Like, she's an expert.
Wow, good for her. That's amazing. So do you remember the first time you saw Satan's Slaves?
Yeah, it was fairly recently after it had come out, I believe. I think I'd heard that it was just this really scary Indonesian film, and I kind of didn't know much about it. I didn't really know the original, so I didn't have a frame of reference of what it was going to be about, but I'm always up for discovering new things, and I'd kind of just heard really scary, you know, Indonesia. I didn't know a ton about the film there, so I was like, this is a new experience for me, and I don't know, it lived up to the hype in my eyes at least.
So the Letterboxd summary, she comes back for the last child. After the death of Rini's mother, something is disturbing her family. So it was written and directed, as mentioned, by Joko Anwar, and it is a remake slash prequel, which is interesting, to the 1980 film of the same name. It was filmed in Bandung, West Java in Indonesia. There's not a lot of like trivia or facts about this movie out there, but the longest part of production was actually them finding the right house that had kind of the atmosphere and tone that they were looking for. And supposedly they spent 3 months looking for this perfect house, only took 18 days to shoot the movie.
That is a crazy way to split your time, but I guess it worked because the house had creepy vibes. Like, it really fit the brief.
It really did. Yeah. So the budget was 2 billion Indonesian rupees, which sounds like a lot of money, but is approximately $133,280 US. So probably about, what, $200,000 Canadian?
Yeah, that's pretty low budget.
It was released on September 28th, 2017, and was the highest grossing domestic Indonesian film of the year, making 155 billion Indonesian rupees, which is about $11.5 million in Indonesia, and an additional $1.5 million in the neighboring country of Malaysia. Really, really good profit on this movie, for sure. And it has gone on to be the best-selling Indonesian horror film and fourth best-selling Indonesian film of all time.
Wow.
Yeah, pretty impressive.
That's awesome. I love when a horror movie is just like top all around, you know? It's not even just the best horror. It's one of the most successful like movies in Indonesia. That's awesome.
It premiered in South Jakarta on September 20th, 2017, and then was released in all Indonesian cinemas on September 28th, followed by Malaysia and Singapore on November 23rd. So it got pretty great reviews overall, especially for a horror movie. So the Straits Times gave it 3.5 stars out of 5 and wrote that the scares are carefully timed and spaced between plenty of character building moments showing the closeness of the family. These soap opera bits have aged the least well, but there is a low key feel to these moments of filial piety that is thoroughly modern. Variety said that the film has high marks when it comes to the fundamental horror movie task of sending shivers up the spine and quickening the pulse. I was watching this movie last night again, and I've seen it before. And I remember when I watched it the first time, I think I had to turn it off because I was like, I can't do this right now. Like, I was so scared at a certain point that I turned it off, which I love horror movies. I've talked about it a lot, but I am also a huge coward when it comes to them. And if I'm home alone, I can't do it. And I think I was home alone watching it, turned it off, and had to wait for my partner to come home for me to watch it. And he didn't even have to be in the room. I just needed him in the house in order to watch it. So yeah, I feel like it definitely does that shivers up the spine and quickening the pulse very well. Jonathan Barkin of Dread Central gave it 3.5 stars out of 5, writing, "Without a doubt, Satan's Slaves is certainly creepy. This Indonesian occult horror remake gets it right." And it won a lot of awards, including the jury prize for scariest film at the 2018 Popcorn Frights Film Festival, as well as best horror film and most scary film at the 2018 Toronto After Dark Film Festival.
I was actually just trying to remember. I was like, I think this played at Toronto After Dark, and that's where I first heard it was scary, but... thank you for confirming.
There you go. And a sequel was just released in August, Satan's Slaves Communion. And the original film becomes the third part of a trilogy, which I haven't seen yet. I have to watch that because I think I would really like it. I've seen the trailer and it looks pretty good.
I didn't even know they made a sequel. So that's exciting. I'm going to have to check that out too.
So the movie opens and we see this woman. She's lying down. She's crying and she's chanting something to herself. Before we transition to this office decorated with records and posters on the wall, it looks like it's like, you know, a music agent or a record label office, something like that. And we see this young woman, Rini, and she's meeting her mother's agent. And he basically tells her that there's no more money coming in from her mother's records. They're just not selling anymore. They won't be getting any more royalties. We learn that their mother is Rini's mother is not doing well. She's been sick for the last 3 years and the family has been struggling financially trying to pay for her treatment. And I think that's one of the saddest things about this family is like there are all these little reminders of how poor they are and how much they are struggling to just survive. Right away, we get this atmosphere where Rini is walking through the woods and then she has to walk through a cemetery to get home. So she goes to the city and then has to come home and on the bus and is walking through kind of these lonely woods and then, like I said, a cemetery. And she arrives home where she lives with her parents. So we have mom Marwani, the dad Bari, his mother Rama, and then we have 16-year-old Tony, 10-year-old Bondi, and 6-year-old Ian, who is deaf. So Rini's relating how her visit went and we hear this bell ringing. So this is how their mother signals that she needs something. And that bell ringing is going to be terrifying very, very quickly.
It's always ominous when a bell is ringing in a horror movie, like especially in like a big kind of, you know, house in the middle of nowhere near a cemetery. Like it's bad news. Get her a different system.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So Rini scolds Bondi for not responding to the bell, but he seems to be kind of scared of his mother. And he's like, why isn't she in the hospital? Which we later learned they can't afford for the mother to be in the hospital, which is why she's at home. And we get a lot of scenes where Rini is climbing up the stairs to her mother's bedroom. And it's always slow. And it's always creepy. But that is nothing compared to when she walks in the room to see her mother lying there pretty much like a corpse. And her hand is dangling off the bed. She's ringing the bell. And Rini's a dutiful daughter. She's like, what do you need? Did you pee? Are you hungry? But her mom just kind of sweeps the bowl that's been sitting on her bedside table to the ground and then starts having a seizure. And she's ringing the bell the whole time that she is convulsing. And I think poor Bondi, like he's got this look of fear when Rainey's kind of scolding him saying, why didn't you go up and see the mom? But like, no wonder, like this would be terrifying for a 10-year-old.
Absolutely. And I really feel for Rainey too in these like situations where she's the eldest daughter. And so it's like all of the caregiving has fallen on her. And there's mm-hmm. all these little kids. There's the sick mother. The dad is traveling a lot, trying to find work and make more money. And she's just really shouldering a lot when she's supposed to just be like a normal 22-year-old.
So Marwani, though, has this look of absolute fear on her. And she's kind of looking up towards the corner of the room. And Rainey, of course, follows her gaze and sees nothing. And I just wanted to call out the music in this scene because I think the music in this whole movie is done really, really well. And it's so tense in this scene as like you're like, what's going on? And you're primed, right? You're like, I know something's going to happen because we know we're watching a horror movie and it's called Satan's Slave. So chances are something's going to happen. And finally, Marwani calms down. Rainey heads out of the room and nothing has really happened. But then the camera zooms in on a mirror with her reflection, Marwani's reflection, as the movie title comes on the screen in like bright red. And downstairs, Bari puts on one of Marwani's old records, which is really beautiful and haunting. And I would love to listen to it, but I feel like I'd be terrified the whole time. He then is like sitting on the porch with his mother. Tony comes home, the oldest son, and he comes back on his motorbike. Family is in such dire straits that Tony is selling his bike and he just wanted to ride it around for a little bit. And he's very stoic about it. Like he doesn't seem like he's not bitter. He's not resentful. He's just like, you know what? It is what it is. Like I had to sell it. And we later learned that he also had to sell his watch to kind of support the family. So Rainey is making dinner and Bondi tells her a superstition that he learned in school that day. And he says that during someone's funeral, once the last family member to leave the funeral takes 40 steps, the dead will wake up. But then when they realize that they're in a burial shroud, they will die again.
Is that real folklore? Do you know?
So I looked it up to try and find out and I could not find anything that says that it is. Like I couldn't find anything about it. So.
Okay. It's very creepy. So even if it's just like a schoolyard thing, some kids made up to scare him, like it's effective.
Yeah, but I think he says his religion teacher told him that. And I'm like, why would your religion teacher tell you that? Especially knowing that this kid's mom is like very, very,
very ill.
Yeah.
The teacher's like, I feel like you're going to be at a funeral very, very soon. So I'm going to give you a warning of what not to do.
Yeah, exactly. The interactions between the siblings ring very, very true. Like at times they're playful, at times they're kind of like they kind of scoff at each other, and at times they're genuinely combative. And I think that, you know, the four siblings play off of each other very, very well.
Yeah, I agree. And I don't want to, you know, get too into we're going to find out later, but they have an interesting dynamic too, especially with their really big age gaps, but they still. Yes. Have that sibling relationship, even though, you know, some of the older siblings are a little more parental to the younger ones, but it still feels like a true family.
Yes. And in fact, it kind of seems like they're, and to your point earlier, where you said the dad's traveling a lot, trying to find work, like it feel they're all that they have, right? So they, I think that's why they're so close. The kids are interrupted, meanwhile, by Marwani, who is ringing her bell. So Tony goes upstairs to brush her hair before bed, which is so dutiful and so loving. Like he's just so gentle with her. But then he starts brushing her hair and clumps of it start coming out. And as he asks what's wrong with her, what's wrong with her hair, a window flies open. So he goes over to close it and then he turns around to find his mother staring at him creepily. And then later that night, everyone is sleeping. That bell starts ringing again. Okay, now maybe I'm just a terrible person, but I would not get up in the middle of the night. Yes, I would. If it were my mother, I would. But watching this, I'm like, no, don't go. Just stay. Stay in bed. Do not go, but they have to. So Rainey gets up to see her her mother, and she notices her father fast asleep on the couch. And the walk to the bedroom is very drawn out. There's this ominous drone that is getting louder and louder as she's climbing the stairs. And then she opens the door to see her mother standing at the window looking out, which is a bit of a shock to her because her mom's been bedridden for so long. She's about to put her hand on her shoulder when Rainey hears the frantic ringing of the bell coming from the bed. And that's not mom at the window because Marwani is in bed looking absolutely terrified. And then as that woman at the window starts to turn slowly, she grins menacingly.
So creepy.
Oh my God, it's so creepy. But it's okay. It's all a dream. It's fine. Except when Rini wakes up from the dream, she hears the bell ringing again and we see the exact same scene start to play out.
See, this is where I'm with you, where I wouldn't get up when the bell rings. If I just had that nightmare and then it starts ringing again, I'd be like, someone else can get it.
Exactly. Or maybe you go, but then the second you see your dad asleep on the couch in exactly the same position, you're like, no, not, it's not happening.
Yeah, dad, it's your turn to go up there. Exactly. I did this once.
This time, however, Marwani is not in bed. She is at the window, but collapses to the ground as she turns away. And the whole family rushes in as Marwani lays dead on the floor. So terrible, but it's going to get much worse. So the next scene is at her funeral and she is laid to rest in her burial shroud. And following the funeral, Bari is speaking with a new neighbor who has just moved to the area with his son, Hendra, who starts chatting up Rini as they're leaving the cemetery. And they refer to the neighbor as Ustad, which in Indonesia denotes a qualified Islamic scholar. And Rini kind of notices Bondi hanging back and he says he's on his 39th step and is thinking about his teacher telling him about the 40 steps, which is so sad. He just has this look of pure concern on his face.
Mm-hmm. Like he really believes it. He thinks if he takes that next step, like it's going to happen. Yeah.
And he stays there for a while, even after Rini tells him that it's not true. And he says, what if mom wakes up? And she's like, well, what are you going to do? Stay here all night? And that eventually gets him moving, which it would, you know, if somebody said to me, you're going to stay in the cemetery all night, I'd be like, nope, I am not. That night at the house, the home is filled with men from the village chanting, there's no God but Allah, as Tony and Bari sit in silence because they're not a praying family. They're not a religious family. In fact, Bari looks quite uncomfortable during this whole scene while Tony is kind of sitting next to him, not kind of sitting next to him, he is sitting next to him, wiping away his tears. Bari later goes to say goodnight to the younger boys and he tells Bondi that they've been grieving for a long time, not just since Marwani passed away, so he doesn't need to be sad because she's at peace now. And he's just very focused on getting them out of their economic struggles. So do you think the dad is being callous or is he just being like he's already kind of grieved and said goodbye to his wife? Like what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think that's something that happens a lot in families where there's someone with like an extended illness where it's sort of like once they actually finally pass, it's almost, I don't want to say relief, but it's almost like, okay, like that's, that part is done. Like we've been grieving, like he says, for a long time. Like since she got sick, we knew she wasn't getting better. We were all preparing for this moment and it happened. So now we can get started on whatever comes next. But I also think, you know, for the young boys, they probably can't rationalize it the same way their father is doing. Yeah. So it might seem a little harsh to them where they're just like, we didn't know that this was what was coming. Like we don't have context for life. We're six.
Yeah, exactly. And before he goes to sleep, Bondi asks his dad if he and Ian can change rooms because he can see the cemetery from his window. And Bari's like, it's okay. The dead are harmless, but the living are what you need to be worried about. You know, there's kidnappers and pickpockets and robbers, which I don't know if that comes across quite as comforting as he wants it to be. And then he's like, don't be so superstitious. He then leaves the youngest kids to go to sleep and he meets Rini and Tony downstairs to tell them that he's leaving the next day to find work because otherwise they're going to lose the house. Their phone's already been disconnected. The bank is ready to repossess the house. So he really needs to find work.
It's a really great setup for, you know, how things are about to get, how scary it's going to be because the family is going to be so isolated and alone. Like the dad who's literal father figure and maybe sort of a figure of safety for them. He's going to be gone and unreachable. Mm-hmm. You don't have a phone. You can't reach anyone. Like no one can come help you. And they think they've already said that they live kind of far from town. Like it's a bit of a trek to get into the town. So it's like they're on their own out there in this house next to a cemetery. And you know nothing good is going to happen.
Exactly. So everyone else is settling in for the night. And Bondi wakes up and looks out the window to the cemetery where he sees someone slowly get up from the ground. And then next to him, a shrouded figure rises. But it's okay because it's only Ian with a blanket over his head. And Ian is, he's just this cute little kid. So it's fine. And Bonnie's like, there's a zombie outside. But Ian's not scared at all. He's a smart little kid. In fact, earlier when Bondi asked him if he was scared and wanted to sleep next to him, he figured out that it was really Bondi who was scared and was like, I'm fine. And now he comments, he's like, that's a pretty smart zombie because it can use a flashlight.
Also, that's a pretty smart six-year-old that he's able to rationalize that. Like, he's very, very precocious.
He is. Bonnie realizes or thinks it's the caretaker of the cemetery and they head back to bed. Tony is up in his room. He's up late. He's listening to his radio and he hears the bell ringing. So he turns off the radio, is momentarily relieved to hear it stop. But it wasn't on the radio and the bell starts ringing again. And he decides to head to his mother's room, which I don't know why he does that. Because all of these kids, every one of them, even Bondi, who is a bit of a scaredy cat, they're all way braver than I would ever be in this situation.
I know. If I thought I heard like the bell ringing, I would be the opposite of him. I would turn that radio up louder and just drown it out. Be like, I don't want to exactly. deal with you right now, ghost.
So he opens the door to his mother's room, he turns on the light, and then hears the bell ring again, and then he sees it drop from midair as if his mom was holding it on the bed to the floor. And he backs up out of the room, closes the door behind him, and runs back to his room and puts the pillow over his head.
Is this the scene that scared you so much you had to take a break when watching it?
No.
Oh, okay. I was guessing it was going to be the bell scene, because I think when I first saw it, I was like, oh no. Oh no. This is too creepy.
It is. It's really creepy. And even watching it again yesterday, I just was like, I can't believe I forgot how much this movie scared me the first time, because it scared me again, even when I knew what was going to happen. So the next morning, Rini is making breakfast, Bondi's skipping school, and he's very concerned about what his classmates will think of him. In fact, the day before, his dad had mentioned something about his clothes being ripped, and he's like, well, I can't go to school with nice clothes. The kids will make fun of me, and they'll bully me. And he can't go back to school the day after his mother's funeral, because everybody will be like, why are you back at school already? And Rini mentions that the plumbing is broken, and they need to get water from the well, which, if you're in a horror movie, stay away from wells. Just stay away from wells in general, I feel like.
Oh my god, I know. The second they're like, we have to go to the well in the basement, I'm like, no, you do not. Find a new water source. And I know there's plenty of homes that have well water and no, like, demonic presences climb out of the wells and try to kill them. So I know, like, realistically, you're probably fine. But I never want to see a well in someone's house.
Mm-mm. Especially after what happens in this well, which we will get to. Tony, meanwhile, is looking through a viewfinder. And for younger people, I don't think they still have viewfinders, but there are these little things that you kind of hold up to your face, and they've got little slides in them, and you flip through them, and they show you different, like, pictures. Very cute, but in, again, like wells, viewfinders, cameras, anything like that, if you're in a horror movie, it's just it's bad news, so... Anyways,
that's the fact that you just described what a viewfinder is, I've never felt older. Like, we have to tell people this?
I feel like we do. I don't know.
No, you're totally right, because it was a huge toy in like the 80s, but you wouldn't have that now. Like, a kid would just be like, oh, a picture? Guess what? Yeah. I have an iPhone and an Xbox.
Exactly. Exactly. Ian, however, is a little bit mischievous, and he really wants this viewfinder. So he picks his nose, wipes his finger on Bonnie's arm. Mission accomplished, he gets the viewfinder. Rini heads to the well to get the water, and as she walks away, we see two figures reflected in what appears to be a mirror or a window. And I couldn't figure it out, because she stops and backs up. She looks into it, and there's nothing there. I like watched this scene so many times because I was like, is it Bondi and Ian? But I don't think it is.
Yeah, I rewound this too to try to look at the figures and figure out what it was. But I don't know if it's clear enough to tell what you're really seeing.
Meanwhile, Bondi has the viewfinder again. I wrote view finger in my notes. The viewfinder. and he's flipping through it in his bedroom. And all the pictures are nice. They're all idyllic. And then suddenly he sees a ghostly woman in a white gown, black background. And it appears to be his mother. Basically, as Rini saw her at the window in her dream. And he drops the viewfinder suddenly, but he picks it up again. And he starts flipping through it. And I was so tense watching this. it just really freaked me out. And this was not the part. I will tell you when I get to the part that
I'm waiting. I want to know what the part was.
And as he's doing this, we see Ian, he's standing in the hallway, he's facing the wall, and he's counting because he's playing hide and seek with his grandmother. And at the end of the hall, there is a portrait of Marwani. And grandma is knocking loudly on the wall so Tony can basically follow the vibrations. And he eventually finds her. And she kind of embraces him and laughing. And I remember watching this being like, this is going to come back to haunt them. That night, Tony is once again in bed, again listening to his radio, and the station changes on its own. And we hear his mother's song play. He changes it back to the original station only for it to switch again. And once he switches it back, which also by this point I'd be turning off my radio and hiding under the covers, the bell starts ringing again and it stops once he turns off the radio. He turns it back on and he hears a ghostly whisper call his name. But then it gets even worse because he hears his mother angrily demand that she comb his hair. And then there she is, a dark shadow with long dark hair sitting next to his bed. I think I would die if that actually happened to me.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. These kids are pretty brave because the fact that that happened to Tony and he didn't just leave town immediately, like, exactly. Impressive.
Yeah. He just tumbles out of bed and he finds he's holding her comb with a clump of hair still in it. And she slowly starts to rise from the ground and he turns on the light. She disappears and so does the comb in his hand. And at this point, you could almost dismiss it as maybe nightmares caused by the trauma of their mom's illness and death. But then Ian wakes up in the night and he has to go to the bathroom. He initially tries to get Bonnie to go with him, but Bonnie's like, no, just go. So he walks down the hallway into the room with the well and he starts to pee. And the camera pans away from him and is focused on the hallway behind him. The perspective shifts and then we see him, we're looking at him from the doorway and he looks so tiny and so vulnerable. And the camera is slowly moving closer and closer to him, shakily, as if something is approaching him. And then something reaches for him, but it's just Bondi because Bondi's decided to come with him after all. So Ian walks away and stops at the hallway telling Bondi that mom is scary. He's talking about the portrait of the mom that is definitely creepy. So this is where I turned the movie off.
Okay.
So Bondi grabs a sheet and the two of them slowly walk towards the picture and Ian's covering his eyes as he gets closer. And Bondi throws the sheet to cover the picture, but instead it covers something standing right in front of them. And I know this is something that has been done before in horror movies, but it still, it scared me so much that I was like, yep, nope, can't watch anymore. I'm done. And turned it off until my partner got home.
Yeah, I don't blame you. Because even like you said, like, you know, something is like that is going to happen in that moment where they're walking slowly with the sheet. And you're just like, this is bad news, kids. Just get out of here. Just run past it really quick. But oh my God, when it's the figure right in front of the portrait and you're just like, okay, I'm sorry, children, you have to burn this house down and find somewhere new to live.
Exactly. The figure just stands there. And so do they for a second before like Bondi like grabs Ian and like they start running back down the hall. And that shrouded figure rushes after them. And the two of them are screaming. They are cowering in the corner and Renee comes running. But the sheet is now just draped on the picture. And Bondi's like, we saw a ghost. But Ian's like, no, Bondi grabbed me. He had his hands over his face the whole time, so he didn't see anything. At this point, with everything that has happened to Bondi and to Tony, and even Rini before her mom died, I'd be like, yeah, I'm done. I'm out. But they stay. And in fact, Tony heads to the cemetery the next day to bury the bell and comb in the dirt covering his mother's grave.
I think maybe this is where the kids need to communicate with one another, because I don't know if they all know that everyone's seeing creepy stuff.
I think that's a really good point.
Yeah, each of them has seen or experienced something, but they haven't like pulled it all together. So we've seen it all. So we're like, guys, you're in trouble. But, you know, Tony probably thinks, oh, I'm just having nightmares because of the trauma. Bondi's just freaked out because he's a little kid. You know, these are all normal, explainable things. But if they put it all together, then they would maybe be a little safer than they currently are.
Yeah, that's an excellent point. Meanwhile, Hendra, the neighbor's son, has befriended Renee and he's telling her that the day they buried her mother, he saw something. And we get this flashback to the day of the funeral. So Hendra is in the grave with his father, laying Marwani to rest. And he sees this woman kind of standing back behind the mourners. And she looks an awful lot like ghostly Marwani. And he's like, I returned to her grave that night, but I found nothing. So it wasn't the caretaker. It was Hendra that Bondi saw, which again, brave that you're going to this. You think you saw this weird thing happen at the cemetery the day of the funeral, and then you decide to go back at night and see what's happening. He tells her that he found nothing, but then a few days later, he walked by their house and saw the same woman in the window. It looked like your mother, he says, and then starts to tell her that he thinks it's an evil entity that has been living in her mother's body. Rainey's like, no, that's just superstition. And he's like, no, you need to move out immediately. And everything would have been so much better for poor Hendra if they did, but they don't. Rainey's like, no, we're fine. Thanks for the offer. And as they're talking about this, Grandma seems to be struggling back at the house. And despite her labored breathing, she stands up from her wheelchair. And then we cut to a new scene, which seems kind of bizarre, but okay. Rainey comes home. She sees Ian sitting in this chest outside, and Grandma's wheelchair is abandoned in the living room. So she and Bondi start looking for her, and then we hear Bondi scream in horror. So of course, Rainey runs right to him. He is in the room with the well, and he points towards the opening. And there's Grandma face down in the water.
So, so upsetting. And, you know, the next scene, they kind of try to explain it as like, oh, she was getting some water and fell in. But I'm just like, why was her wheelchair in another room? Like, what purpose was she getting water for? Like, I don't know, kids. Exactly. Once again, I would be very concerned.
Yeah. So they bury her very quickly, which I'm assuming, and I should have researched this, is Islamic custom. And Hendra apologizes because he really blames himself for asking Rainey to go for a walk. And he thinks that if Rainey had been there, this wouldn't have happened. Bondi is in shock. They can't get a hold of their dad. Just a bad situation all around. So Rainey finds his letter that her grandmother had written to someone named Butterman. And this sends her straight back to Hendra to ask him to take her to town. So they're going to go see this Butterman person and give him the letter. So when they arrive, Rainey says that in the letter, her grandmother asks him to save them. And I love how he's just like, that's really rude that you read my letter.
I know. And then she's like, well, you know, who are you? Why did she want your help? And he's like, well, I haven't even read it yet. Give me a minute.
She wants to know what are you supposed to save us from? So he ends up inviting them in, and he tells them that he has a long history with their grandmother. And I get that she wants answers, but like, Tony's not at home, and she's left poor Bondi at home, and Bondi's like traumatized. But anyways, she needed to see Butterman. So he tells them that her grandma didn't approve of her dad, Bari, marrying Marwani, because Marwani was an artist, which just wasn't acceptable. And we learned that things did get better between Marwani and the grandmother when Rainey was born, but then the grandmother grew suspicious because Marwani didn't get pregnant for a very long time. And the grandmother believed that she didn't pray to God to get pregnant, that she asked for children from Satan. And that's why she got so sick. And Rainey, pretty much right up onto almost the very end of the movie, is very skeptical. Butterman is like, but if you don't believe, then why are you here? Which, fair point. And he realizes that something has happened to bring her to him. Meanwhile, Bondi is lying in bed. His eyes are closed and he is muttering that he doesn't want to kill his little brother. We go back to Butterman's apartment and we learn that he's a published writer, and he gives Rainey a magazine that has one of his articles in it. And he's like, I think this will help you. And suddenly his door opens and there is a blind man standing there. And it's so scary, but then it's so funny because it's just his masseuse there to give him his massage. And he lost his glasses. And so you think that this is like this horrible thing that's going to happen. And no, it's fine. I don't think I noticed it the first time I watched it. I noticed it more this time around, just how funny it is. There are some genuinely funny moments in this movie.
Yeah, it kind of breaks up the tension a little, because like in this scene where the blind man comes in, like at first you think like, oh, he's here for them. Like he's going to attack them. Something shady and scary is happening. And then it's just sort of like a little like, you know, comedic beat. And then you're like, oh, like now I've let my guard down again. And the movie's like, well, that was a mistake.
So that's all the info that Rainey and Hendra are going to get from Butterman. But before they leave, Butterman's like, they won't be able to take you if you love each other. And so she arrives home And she finds Bondi acting strange. He's eating by himself. He's really not talking to the others. And she forces him to the table where he just glares at Ian. And she tells them, we need to take care of each other. So Tony tucks the boys in for the night. If I were Ian, I would not be sleeping in that room with my brother who was talking earlier about how he didn't want to kill me. And he wakes up in the night to see Bondi signing to him, seemingly in his sleep, I want you to die. Which just seems rude and unnecessary.
Yeah, and especially like, you know, when Bondi's kind of talking and whispering to himself earlier because Ian's deaf, he doesn't know about it, but like signing in your sleep, that is next level. That is like targeted. That is, I'm not even just mumbling to myself because that's something I do all the time when I'm sleeping. I am specifically sending you a message.
Yeah, exactly. But somehow Ian just tries to go back to sleep and then turns over to see Bondi standing next to his bed before Bondi kind of sleepwalks back to his own bed. Ian, not surprisingly, gets up at this point and then we hear knocking on the wall and he follows the vibrations to the well room and slowly opens the double doors partway. And we catch a glimpse of, is it ghost mom or ghost grandma? I think it's ghost grandma before yeah. Ian runs back down the hall. And then gets his pajamas snagged on a hook. And the doors continue to open so slowly. And we hear the asthmatic breathing of Grandma as two hands come out and grip the doors before suddenly closing them again. And you just think, Ian's so sweet and and so vulnerable. And like the scene is just terrifying when he gets that, like that little snag on his pajamas. And you're just like, just rip it, kid. Just go.
I know. And you said before, too, they do a good job of showing just how small he really is. Like, he's, mm-hmm. he's a six-year-old. He's truly, like, a very small, vulnerable child. He doesn't have the strength to free himself yeah. from, like, a hook that's caught on his pajamas. And he's just struggling and doesn't know what to do. He doesn't have, like, the dexterity to unhook himself. Like, you just really feel like this is a mm-hmm. child in danger.
So the next day, Rini is going to put on her mother's hit record, and it sounds kind of warped and distorted. So she picks it up, and she's looking at it, and she peels off the label and sees that there's another track there. So she begins to play it and hears this ancient chanting, which is not generally a good sign. And she like plays it backwards, and it's just – it's a whole vibe. She then goes to check on her brothers, but she can't locate – Ian. She only sees Bondi lying in bed. So she and Tony start looking for Ian. The music is incredibly ominous. The camera angle is skewed. And it actually made me think of the Evil Dead a little bit when like they've got that like the deer head mounted on the wall and then the camera goes like at an angle. Mm-hmm. The sense that everything is off kilter for this family is very, very strong. And then Rini finds him fast asleep in a chest outside, which we'd seen him in earlier. So apparently this is a place that he likes to just go and hang out. But while looking for him, Tony finds the magazine that Buttermann had given Rini and asks her if she's read it. And I'm like, what is in this magazine? I want to know. I want to know what is in this magazine.
I know. I don't know why Rini didn't just like pore over it immediately. She's kind of, like you said, she's very skeptical, maybe a little mm-hmm. dismissive of the whole like something evil is afoot idea. But I would still just be like, clearly my grandmother believed something was up, so I at least want to know exactly what she thought.
The magazine tells the story of a woman who tried to have a child for 10 years, but couldn't until she went to ask Satan for help. And then Tony tells her that in the cities, there are Satan-worshipping cults that women can join, and then they will have a baby. And Rainey's like, I don't see what the big deal is. Like, at least they end up with a baby. But she's very pragmatic. And Tony's like, no, the last child, once they reach the age of 7, that child is sacrificed to Satan. So he's figured it out. He's like, think about it. How old am I? How old are you? How old? And he kind of goes through all of them, pointing out that their mom had them at 6-year intervals so that she didn't have to give any of them to the cult. And he starts telling her about how, like, when he would go and see his mom sing, there was always a group of people around her, people who didn't mingle with others. They just kind of kept to themselves and they are always there. And then they take out like a photo album and he's going through it. And he's like, this person and this person and this person. And then points out the very, very bad news, which is that Ian is about to turn 7 in a few days. However, the family has to be willing to give him up to the living dead. And up to this point, Tony is all in, but then he's like, but I don't believe in the living dead, and neither does Rini. So the next time you see Ian, you're like, I just want to hold you tight and protect you because you're this sweet, innocent boy, and I don't want bad things to happen to you.
I do love how Tony and Rini were like, okay, satanic cult, sure. Sacrificing children, of course. Living dead, no.
That's where I draw the line.
And I'm like, okay, maybe living dead is like a euphemism and someone is going to come take this child. You should still be prepared for this.
Exactly. Especially with all of the things that have been happening to them. At this point. Especially Tony.
Yeah, you've seen ghosts already. Why are you convinced that there's no such thing as the living dead?
So Grandma's still sticking around and we see her wheelchair move towards Rini as she's feeding Ian. And every time her ghost is around, you hear this, the sound of her wheezing. And Rini does see her reflection in some glass in a cabinet. So what do you do when you have ghosts plaguing your house and you don't live in New York City and can't call the Ghostbusters? You call in an expert. In this case, their new neighbor, Usted. So after visiting Marwani's room, he's like, the dead don't bother the living. It is some other being that is trying to drive your family apart. And he's like, I will pray for you. And then advises them to pray for themselves. And things start to amp up now. Even like skeptical Rini sees Marwani as she prepares to pray. And I thought this was one of my favorite parts about this movie, and I'm sure we'll talk about it in a little bit, is I liked seeing kind of a different take on a ghost story. Like the Muslim take on a ghost story I thought was really interesting because it's a different perspective than we normally see from North American ghost stories anyways, or satanic movies, I guess.
Yeah, like, yeah, it is definitely interesting because we do usually see it from like a Christian perspective, even if the movie's not overtly Christian. It's still mm-hmm. very much like sign of the cross, and this is how you do this kind of stuff. And this is sort of showing just a different approach of like, well, how do you deal with demons and Satans if you're not Christian? And other religions have their own things that they're worried about.
So she begins to pray. She's put on her prayer shawl and the younger boys are asleep. One thing that horror movies have taught me, it's that when you bring religion into the mix, ghosts and demons become very, very agitated. Mm-hmm. And sure enough, Marwani is now standing outside the window. She is watching Rini while inside the boys' bedroom. Ian first hears his grandmother's breathing before seeing her leaning over Bondi as he sleeps. And Rini is kneeling forward to pray. You know that at some point when she comes back up, her mother is going to be there. And sure enough, there she is, but she's behind her, so Rini doesn't see her until she's suddenly in front of her. Rini naturally freaks out and is basically swallowed up by her prayer shawl. And Marwani crawls under it, first just her hands coming under, and then she comes closer and closer with this grin on her face. At this point, Marwani's like, that's enough. Like, I'm out. She grabs the boys and they head to Usted's home. Rini is convinced, though, that they just need to ask their mom to leave them alone, but Tony's like, that was not our mom. And Hendra explains that there are more beings than just demons and djinns, saying they want to harvest the souls they have planted, which is so ominous. Mm-hmm. And Tony, having read the magazine, is now an occult expert. He's like, we can't beat them, but we don't have to obey their rules. He's like, we stick together, we don't give up, Ian, which sounds like a solid plan.
Yes, except no one has noticed yet that Bondi is really possibly possessed.
No one has noticed it. And he is clearly, something is very wrong with him.
Yeah. Like, even when they're like, we'll all stick together and everything will be great. Like, one kid is like angry, dark, sunken eyes, muttering to himself in the corner. Like, I would worry about this.
Then Tony reveals the big secret, that they don't have the same father. Their mom was impregnated by different members of the cult, which is why they all look so different.
I really liked that sort of reveal. I guess it's not necessarily like a twist, but I thought it was really clever because in movies, when you have siblings, and especially like they've already explained why these siblings are so far apart in age, it's also a way to explain like why they all look different. The real answer is, of course, they're actors and not a real family. But the way that they were able to kind of bring that in and be like, you like probably acknowledged on some level that they didn't look alike, but you just kind of assumed it was just movie logic. But now it's going, oh, no, that was actually a hint that something else was going on.
Yeah, it's brilliant. So Hendra gets a call from Buttiman and he leaves to go see him. As Usedd tells Rainey, we're going to hold a mass prayer at your house. And he does guilt her a little bit, saying that because her family doesn't pray, it's going to be a little more tricky to fix the problem, but they can take care of it. Buttiman gives Hendra his latest article and says, we can't wait for it to be published or it'll be too late to save the family. And he then puts some music on, he cranks the volume, and he whispers something to Hendra, but we don't get to hear what he says. Meanwhile, back at Usted's house, Bondi is clearly possessed, as we mentioned, and he is just staring malevolently at Ian as Ian is watching TV. And he's taken a knife and he's kind of hiding it behind his back and appears to be like ready to use it. But then Rainey sees it and takes it from him. And again, Rainey's not like, oh, why are you hiding this knife behind your back and like clearly acting all weird? But that's okay. Hendra has left. Buttiman is alone in his apartment. And his masseuse arrives again earlier than expected. And this time it's not played for laughs because Buttiman actually arms himself with a club or something. And the visitor is jiggling the door handle. And it's pretty menacing. And then we switch back to Hendra. So we don't see what happens to Buttiman. Hendra really should have worn a helmet because he's driving on his little motorbike. He has to swerve to avoid hitting someone who literally runs out into the road from the bushes. And Hendra gets hit by a truck. His head gets squished like a grape. This is the goriest part of the movie by far.
Absolutely. And I kind of like... I always love this point in the movie where it's like things are getting ramped up and this is just ramping it up so much because up until now we've seen maybe some ghosts, we've got maybe some demonic energy, maybe some possession, but now we're getting into like there's a cult and there are human people who are covering their tracks. So they're coming for Buttiman, they're coming, pushing people into traffic. Blood all over the street, like they are to be worried about, which is what the dad said earlier, where he was like, worry about the living, don't worry about, you know, zombies coming back to life, worry about people, they will mess you up. Like, he knew.
So Hendra's body is brought home and the absolute anguish on his father's face is just gut-wrenching. But as they're carrying the body into the house, that the unpublished article has fallen from his pocket and Rainey picks it up, puts it in her pocket before heading back into the house. And that night she falls asleep at the kitchen table before being woken up by the window opening. And as she goes to close it, she sees what appears to be Hendra before he disappears. But then something grabs her and is trying to pull her out of the window. Tony rushes to her rescue and Usedd, looking absolutely broken, just slowly closes the door. The siblings manage to pull Rainey away and as they huddle together against another door, someone opens it behind them. It's their dad. His timing's not great, but you know, he arrived home. He found them not there, so he came here looking for them. So they all return home and Bari's like, that's it. We're leaving the next day. He's getting ready for bed and of course it's a dark and stormy night. Rainey comes to speak with him. And when he apologizes for leaving, she's like, that's not all you need to apologize for. She wants to know what he said to Marwani before she died. And he's like, I didn't want you to suffer. And all of a sudden, they're suddenly interrupted by Tony yelling for them. He's brought Ian to the well to pee, but suddenly the door slammed and Ian is pulled into the well. So Bari immediately jumps in. He starts looking for his son and luckily finds him. Rainey and Tony toss the rope down so they can climb back up. But of course, they're not alone in the well, and we see Grandma's ghost slowly emerging from the water. They manage to get out. I don't even know that they saw the grandma, but they do see a group of black figures carrying umbrellas slowly approaching the house. Rainey has a little bit of a Jennifer Love Hewitt moment when she's like, what do you want from us? Before slamming the door shut. And they all realize they're there to take Ian and things just escalate. So grandma's wheelchair is flying through the air at them. Furniture is whipping around. The older siblings and the dad end up separated from Bondi and Ian. They're kind of trapped in a room while Bondi and Ian are in the living room. And Ian is basically being sucked into the well room by these like winds that are just whipping around the house. And we see this dark figure of grandma lurking and Bondi's hiding behind a pillar. And overlaid over this scene is the sound of grandma's wheezing, and it's so creepy. Bari's stuck in the room with his kids. He's begging his mother and Marwani to save his children. And Ian tells Bondi that he loves him, and I'm like, I'm done. I'm just done. This, though, snaps Bondi out of the trance he's been in, and he heads to his brother's rescue. somehow doing this causes the chaos to break. The door to the well room slams shut. Grandma's sucked back into the well, and the door that is keeping Bari from the boys opens. They have a quick reunion. Bari and Tony head outside, and Bari's screaming at those surrounding the house, saying, "You can't take my children. I will fight you." And Tony grabs him and drags him back inside. Seemingly, this works because the cult members collectively point at the house before making this kind of wiggly gesture like they're dropping something with their hands and disappear. So the family does manage to last the night. They're packing to leave the next day. They're like, we're going. And whether it's because they have to leave because of their money situation, or it's a combination of that and all the horrible things that are happening, they're ready to go. Bari's like, "I'm going to work hard. I'm going to buy back the house." But Tony and Rena are like, "No, let's just find a place to stay with lots of neighbors."
Yeah. Yeah. I would not want to come back to this house. I would be like, "You know, Dad, I'm good. Yeah. I'm really good. We can let the bank take this one."
So he's like, "We're going to stay up late tonight and we're going to celebrate Ian's birthday at midnight." And everything seems great as they're waiting for the car. The car's supposed to come pick them up at 4:30. They're singing, they're dancing, they're playing the ukulele, but that gets old quick and they kind of succumb to boredom. And it's a very quick little shot, but it's funny the way it's like they're like all happy and they're excited to be leaving and everything's good. And then all of a sudden they're like, "Oh my God, I'm so bored." And Usted shows up to wish them good luck. And Rainey's like, "I'm going to go for one last walk." She's still feeling a bit uneasy. And then she sees these little seeds, these little red seeds on the ground. Usted apologizes to Bari for not helping the night before, saying he was in shock. And meanwhile, the time that the car was supposed to pick them up has long passed and night has fallen. The lights all go out suddenly. And despite everything that has happened, they are not the least bit concerned.
Yeah, I mean, even when they're waiting for the moving van and they realize it's not coming and then they're like, "Oh, okay, maybe there was an issue." I'm like, "Guys,
exactly.
The issue is Satan."
I think that's the episode soundbite right there. The issue is Satan. But luckily they have some kerosene lamps on hand, which, let's be honest, just makes everything so much scarier. Rainey wakes up in the night and suddenly thinks, "Oh, I forgot to read those papers that I picked up when Hendra had died." So she starts to read, and Butterman, it turns out, is quite a colorful writer because the article is titled "Satan's Grand Plan to Spread His Seeds."
I really want to know, like, I want to get a subscription to whatever magazine Butterman is writing for. Like, what is this?
Oh gosh, yeah, that would be fantastic.
Weekly exposés on satanic cults, like, what?
Ooh, can you imagine what he'd say about Hereditary?
Oh my gosh, yeah, we need to have a crossover, put him in that movie.
Exactly. So she wakes Tony up. The clock behind them shows that it's 11:55, so it is 5 minutes to Ian's 7th birthday. And she's like, "Have you ever been haunted by Grandma's ghost?" And he's like, "No." She's like, "No, neither have I, neither has Bondi. Grandma's ghost has only ever haunted Ian." So the new article is a revision of the original article. We all thought, you know, Ian was this sweet, vulnerable kid and you just want to protect him at all costs. No, it turns out that the last child will not be taken because the last child is Satan's kid.
Dun, dun, dun.
It's such a good twist because you realize that Grandma was actually trying to help them all along. And I feel like Grandma is the one that possessed Bondi to try and kill Ian to save everybody else. That's my theory.
Yeah, like the grandmother ghost, they do a good job because she seems really creepy, but you don't actually see her, like, you know, doing anything to hurt anyone, really. She's always just trying to come get Ian.
Yeah.
So then once you realize, like, oh, she's trying to protect the family, like, she knows, and it's probably Ian that pushed her down the well.
Yeah, because they were alone, right? They was just her and Ian, I think, at the house. So Tony is now the skeptical one, and he's like, "No, you're nuts, sis." But she's like, "No, the cult members showed up to the house the night before to basically leave a trail to the child, to Ian, for the shepherds." And then the bell starts to ring. So Rainey and Tony, they check out the stairway and they see their mother slowly coming up the stairs. And then we see Ian standing at his bedroom window talking away. And Bondi wakes up and he's like, "What are you doing?" And he's like, "Talking to my friends."
That is so, like, eerie and creepy, especially because, you know, up until this point, like, Ian was deaf. And then now he's hearing Bondi, he's speaking instead of signing, and you're just like, hang on, child, what is this?
To this kid's credit, like, he is a good actor, because all along you think he's just sweet and innocent. And then all of a sudden he is so scary, and he giggles walking out of the room and into the hallway, and it's just so creepy. And then we see a bevy of the undead standing outside the window. One of my favorite pieces of trivia about this movie, and like I said, there's not a lot, but supposedly production hired 24 extras to play the undead in the movie. And when the team went over the like shots for this scene, they noticed something strange, because they counted and there were 25 instead of 24.
Oh no, that's so scary.
Yeah. Bahri, meanwhile, is sleeping through all of these new developments. He doesn't know that his son is actually the son of Satan. and Bondi has taken the smart approach. He is hiding under the bed, or I think it's under the bed, and he sees some zombie feet in front of him. Usted has been sleeping in the kitchen, and he wakes up and he sees one of the zombies walking through the house, and he follows before realizing that it's Hendra, and then he can't back up because there are more zombies behind him. Ian, little demon spawn that he is, has now grabbed a knife, which probably not going to go well. Speaking of not going well, Bahri wakes up and he hears a bell ringing before finding it under his pillow, the bell that his son buried a few days before, and his zombie wife is in bed next to him.
Oh no, that is not what you want to wake up to. Especially like they kind of thought it was all over, and then now it's just so much worse than it was.
So much worse. So he flees from the room, he locks the door behind him, and gathers the older children as they go in search of the younger boys. Unfortunately, they find Usted mortally wounded before they find Bondi. So did the zombies hurt Usted, or did Ian hurt Usted?
I think the zombies. And I think because he is a religious figure, they knew that he was a threat, so they were trying to get him out of the way first. That's my theory.
That makes sense. That's what I had always assumed. And then as we were talking, I'm like, but Ian had a knife. But I think it was the zombies. You're right.
No, that is a good point. Maybe it was little Ian, but I just feel like even if you are the son of Satan, I could probably take a 6-year-old.
That's true. Bahri wants to know where Ian is. And that is a very, very good question, because really you should stay as far away from him as you possibly can. Rini is watching through a crack in the door, and she sees Ian come down the stairs, followed by his mom, who is still ringing the bell. And she's like, we need to stay in this room. But Bahri doesn't know the whole story. He wants to save Ian. And then that song, the mom's hit single, kicks in, and it is so haunting. Bahri goes outside. He sees Ian surrounded by the undead. He's got his mom at his side, and he tells him to come to him. And Tony's like, no, Dad, you're not going. And he drags him back into the house. Once again, Tony to the rescue. And they lock themselves in as they see zombies flanking them. But unfortunately, that lock is no match for the zombies, and they bust into the house. The family does manage to get into another room, and we see Grandma's wheelchair moving towards the door. And then Grandma herself appears, and she literally holds the door against the undead to protect her son and her grandchildren.
What a good grandma ghost, honestly.
Right? Oh, I know. And like, the first time I saw this, I felt so bad that I thought the grandma ghost was evil the whole time.
Right? Because they do, like, she seems really creepy, and you're just like, oh, something's wrong with that evil grandmother. Mm-hmm. And then here, you're just like, even in death, this woman does not rest. She's protecting her family. She's a great person.
Butterman has fantastic timing and bursts into the room. So he survived his run-in with the cult. And he's like, come with me. They pile into his car. But of course, in true horror movie fashion, he has trouble getting the car to start. They do manage to drive away. And Butterman tells Bahri that Ian isn't his son, and he never has been. Which is just a kick in the pants.
Yeah, can we just take a moment to say that Bahri has had a really tough week? His wife died, he left town and came back to find out his mother died, and then now his youngest son is the son of Satan. It's like, that's a lot of L's to take in one week.
It's true. And hopefully he doesn't find out that the other kids aren't his biological kids as well.
That's true. I hope the kids keep that to themselves.
So we fast forward. It's 1 year later. The family is living in a flat in the city with lots of neighbors, just like the kids had asked. And a kindly neighbor has brought them some food. And she's like, I made too much. I thought of you, which is great because the family is still struggling financially. But then we follow the neighbor home, and her husband reminds her that they have to keep them from moving out, which right away you're like, oh my God, the good neighbor thing is an act and these people are part of the cult. And then the wife's like, it's time for another harvest. And we see this map with little pushpins stuck all over it before the camera pans down to the record player. And next to it is a glass jar filled with those little red seeds. And then the couple dances together as the credits roll.
Oh, yeah. I do love an ending like that where it's you see that the cult is just so much more widespread. You think it's this one family that's in danger, but really there's so many other families around the country that they're going to have to go through the same thing. And mm-hmm. What are those red seeds like even really mean? And what is happening? What are they harvesting? Is it all just souls? Like how many people are involved? Like it opens up so many possibilities.
So what stood out for you? What made this a great horror movie for you?
I think that for me, there's some really good scares, like some genuinely scary moments, which I know we've touched on, like the shroud, the ghosts, the bells, but I like how it is sort of unraveling, like each kind of different part of the movie, you're seeing another piece of the puzzle, where at first you're thinking, maybe it's just a haunted house story, maybe it's just a ghost. And then next thing you know, oh, it's demonic, maybe it's possession. And then, oh, maybe it's a cult, it's large. And then, oh, it's zombies. You know, it keeps leveling up until you're finally just so much has happened. And you're so it's such an intense movie by the end.
Yeah, it's kind of like a kitchen sink of a horror movie. Like mm-hmm. you've got the ghosts, you've got like the cult, you've got Satan, you've got zombies, you've got a little bit of gore, but not too much. Yeah, it really does just keep throwing things at you, but it ties them all together so well. And I think, like you said, there are a lot of really great scares and they should be predictable. Like a lot of them are things that you're like, yeah, I've seen this in a horror movie before, but it's still done so well that it's still terrifying. Mm-hmm. And I think the setting has a lot to do with it. Like we talked about the house being kind of in this, like isolated from everyone else. And there's that well, the setting really plays into it. Do you have a favorite scary scene in the movie?
Ooh, good question. I do think that first scene where Tony goes upstairs and the bell is ringing midair is a good mm-hmm. one, just because I think that's the first like proper scare that really creeps me out. But then, yeah, the shroud or the covering the portrait, but it's covering the figure in the hallway is just truly terrifying. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, anything involving the well. Anytime they're going into that well room, even if nothing happens, now that I know there's a well in that room, I'm mm-hmm. on the edge of my seat thinking something bad is going to happen.
Yeah. And there's so many little scenes where, like, if you blink, you'll miss, like, the little, like, flash of somebody in the glass. Mm-hmm. Or there's, like, a scene that I didn't talk about, but when Usad comes to the house and he's like, we're going to pray and, like, and it will have a, you know, this isn't your grandmother. It's some other being that is pretending to be your grandmother. But you see a flash of the ghost in the mirror and like it's so quick that you could miss it so easily. And it does those kind of like really quick flash scares really well. I'm really fascinated by horror in different cultures. And how some things are just scary. No matter where you are or mm-hmm. who you are, some things just translate so well as horror.
One thing that I was thinking through, like, I think I thought this the first time I watched it, and then I remembered when I was rewatching it for this, where the first time I watched it, I was convinced there was going to be a twist that the dad knew and was in with the cult, and that's why he had left, so that it would just take the kids while he was gone.
Ooh, I never even thought of that.
Yeah, I was so convinced, because I'm like, if the grandmother was suspicious, she knew. Like, the mom's not doing this all on her own and having the cult come to her concerts, and the dad's totally clueless. So then I was remembering that as I rewatched it. So I just wanted to get your take on that. Like, do you think the dad was truly clueless this whole time?
I don't know. That's a really good question. Because you would think, like, that he would, after all of these years, like, they've been together for, well, we know Renee's 22. And so we know that the mom had trouble getting pregnant for years. So they've been together for at least, what, 25, 30 years, I guess-ish. Yeah. So you would think he would be suspicious of something, especially if his mother was suspicious. But he seems like a genuinely caring dad. And he does when he comes back. I feel like he really like fights for his family. And I think maybe the fact that we see him sleeping so much is supposed to be a sign, like a sign, look how oblivious this guy is that he can just sleep through all of this. I don't know. I don't think he knows. Maybe he's suspicious that something weird was happening, but I don't think that he maybe knew the full extent of it.
Yeah, I think that's ultimately where I come down. Like, he definitely doesn't act like he knows or doesn't care. Like, he is really protective of the kids. He's trying to fight the cult. Like, he's not, I don't think he was in on it, but I'm just, you know, that first time watch, I was waiting for that twist when the dad came back and was like, actually, I'm here to help them. I'm going to sacrifice you.
did you, when you first watched it, did you figure out that Ian was like little demon spawn?
No, I did not. Yeah, I really was like, I guess maybe it makes sense because they do point out that all the kids are 6 years apart in age, except Ian. He's only a few years younger than Bondi. So that's I'm true. Like, maybe there's something there where they were like, we have ours now, like our three kids. And so I guess we can have the Satan kid anytime.
Right, right. They broke the pattern. Yeah, I didn't see that. I didn't see the Ian reveal coming at all. And I didn't see the grandma reveal at all coming. And I think they do it with, like, I think part of it has to do with when you hear her breathing, it just, even though it's just, she's asthmatic or like she's got some kind of respiratory illness and that's why she breathes like that. But in the movie, it comes across as so creepy and so scary. And you know that she's around whenever you hear that noise. And I think they just do a great job of making her seem so menacing. And I guess because if you don't see the Ian thing coming, then you're not going to put two and two together and go, oh, she's actually trying to protect the family from him.
Yeah, exactly. You think she must be, or even like they say a few times, oh, it's not your mother. It's not your grandmother. It's something else. So like you think the ghost is a demon, but it's just taking the form of the grandmother.
I'm really interested in seeing the next movie and seeing like what happened to Ian.
Yeah.
She's still out there.
Because that they don't really explain, which I think is good. They don't really go into too much detail about what's actually happening with the cult and the children of Satan and whatnot. Does that mean, like, does Ian grow up to just be one of the cult members and he starts harvesting children? Or, like, are they taken for a larger purpose?
Now I feel like I need to watch the original as well as the one that just came out.
Yeah, yeah, I haven't seen the original either. I should probably check that out.
Which is funny. I've seen the Queen of Black Magic and the Queen of the original The Queen of Black Magic, which are other Indonesian horror movies. And but for some reason, I've never seen the original of this. And it is available on Tubi, so you can watch it for free.
Love that. Love a free movie.
Right? I know. Quick question before we get to the body count. So what do you think, because Rainey asks the dad, what did you say to mom the night she died? And he says he didn't want the kids to suffer anymore, but then he doesn't really elaborate. So what do you think he says to her?
Great question. Oh gosh. Because then it comes back to like, does the dad know anything? Because if he does know something, then I would think he's whispering to Marwani something like, you know, save the children. Don't let them take our children. Like, right. If you're going to the other side, tell your demon friends that you made a mistake and we don't want to give up our kids, actually. But then if he doesn't know anything, maybe he's just, you know, maybe it's just a private moment between a man and his dying wife. And he's just whispering something like, you know, I love you. I'll take care of our kids. Like, if it's time for you to go, you can go. Right. Something like of that nature.
Now that I'm thinking, like, did the dad know? Like, and like I said, that's not really anything that crossed my mind before until you brought it up. But yeah, now that I'm thinking that, I'm like, ooh, was he just talking to her about the cult and like what was going to happen next? Okay, so body counts. So we had four. So Marwani, Grandma, Hendra, and Usted. And maybe others who knows with this cult, but because they're clearly widespread. So on a scale of 1 through 5, how many scaredy cat screams would you give it?
Ooh, I think I'm going to go 4 just because I'm really picky about giving things a full 5.
That's fair. That's fair. I think I would agree with that. I don't often rate movies when we record. I leave that up to everyone else, which I realize is very unfair of me, but I hate rating things. But I would agree. I think it is it's a solid four. Scary. It's atmospheric. It does everything that I want it to do. Awesome. Well, tell us where we can find you and tell us about where we can find your podcast.
Yeah. So the podcast is I Hate Your Taste in Movies. You can find us on any podcast provider, Apple, Spotify, etc. Social media, we're on Instagram at Hate Your Taste Pod and Twitter at I Hate Your Taste. And if you want to follow me as a person for some reason, I'm also on Twitter and Instagram at Jen Alice Reed, which is my full name.
Well, thank you for joining us today. You can catch us on Twitter at @CatScaredy and on Instagram at @ScaredyCatsThePodcast. I think it's funny that I've been doing this podcast for over 2 years now and I can never remember my own Twitter and Instagram handles. But anyways, subscribe wherever you find podcasts and don't forget to let us know what you think by leaving us a review. Until next time, stay scared.